Please be seated. The next case on this panel's agenda for oral argument is Fortino Sanchez v. State, case number 60582. Mr. Speed, you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
All right. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Justice and the rule of law require that we lay down neither our arms or our armor in the face of unfairness. For to do so would be to deny the people accused of the most extraordinarily egregious and profoundly disturbing crimes due process of law. And it may be disturbing when we're faced with the possibility of giving those people a second chance. But once again, justice requires that we do so. Assembled Justices, Mr. Justice Sherry, Mr. Justice Hardesty, Mr. Justice Douglas, we have 13 points that we've laid out in our brief for Mr. Sanchez. And may it please the Court, we believe that all of them merit the Court's attention, but the utterly dismissive three are the ones that I hope I can elucidate for the panel this afternoon. And those are, first, that reversal is warranted because of the district court's error in its refusal to sever the counts involving the complaining witness EV from those involving the complaining witness Mia. Secondly, that this court must reverse Mr. Sanchez's convictions because of the prosecution's violations of the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments to the Nevada and U.S. Constitutions by committing repeated acts of misconduct during the trial and the district court's error in denying mistrial based on this misconduct. And third, how the government's discriminatory jury selection practices in violation of Batson versus Kentucky constituted structural error that mandate reversal of Mr. Sanchez's convictions. Finally, I believe that all of those things together, all of these incidents of misconduct and error, if the court finds any one to be individually harmless, we believe that together, when viewing the trial as a whole, that they constitute cumulative error. And also on those grounds, we believe that Mr. Sanchez's conviction warrants reversal. Let's begin with severance. First, the trial court erred when it refused to sever the joint offenses. Mr. Sanchez was charged with several counts of lewdness with a child under 14 and sexual assault with a child under 14, alleged to be committed against, who have been committed against his step granddaughters and step-nieces, one being the natural father or the natural child of his nephew, and the other being a stepchild of that same nephew. Under NRS 173-115, we know that two or more offenses may be charged in the same indictment or information or in a separate count for each offense if the offenses are based on the same act or transaction, or based on two or more acts connected together, or based on a common scheme or plan. Well, what did we see in Mr. Sanchez's trial? We know that the offenses that he was charged with were not part of the same transaction, nor were they part of a common scheme or plan. In fact, the crimes that were alleged to have been committed against Mia predated those that were alleged against Emily by some 10 years or more. And in the case law that gives us guidance in these kinds of cases, in determining whether a common scheme or plan or the same transaction is presented to the court in a case for review, the periods of separation were much shorter, significantly shorter, days in most of those cases. 50 days in one case, 45 days in another. Here, as an example, we have over a decade, 10 years, between the allegations of misconduct. The cases against Mr. Sanchez were not cross-admissible. The allegations against the two children were not cross-admissible. They should not have been cross-admissible in a trial had they been held separately. One, because the crimes are similar, does not mean that they are certainly related to merit joinder. And we know from our case law that just because acts are similar or sufficiently unique, they have to have some signature separation or something that sets them apart from one another to merit joinder in a situation like this one. And we did not have that in Mr. Sanchez's case. The state will argue that because these were crimes committed against young female family members when the favorite uncle or the supposed favorite uncle came to Las Vegas to visit them, then they are sufficiently alike or sufficiently similar enough to have warranted joinder in this case. But we believe, based on the evidence that was presented to the trial court in our motion to sever before trial and also in our renewed objections to having both crimes or both sets of cases tried together as one, we believe that the state did not meet its burden of showing a unique similarity between the two counts. A third, we believe that the prejudice occasioned by the joinder of these offenses outweighed any considerations of judicial economy. Our case law tells us that severance should be granted where there is a serious risk that the jury may not make a reliable judgment about guilt or innocence. In Tavish v. State, this court went on to say that the critical question is whether joinder is so manifestly prejudicial that it outweighs the dominant concern of judicial economy and compels the exercise of the court's discretion to sever. Or what did we see in Mr. Sanchez's case? The dual allegations against both the child E.V. and Mia, who was an adult at the time of Mr. Sanchez's trial, unfairly cross-corroborated one another. And the Chief Deputy District Attorney who prosecuted that case admitted as much in her closing argument. Several times throughout her summation, we heard the counsel for the government say, we have corroboration, we have corroboration. It's Uncle Tino, it's whenever Uncle Tino comes to visit. But what did we notice that was unique about these two complaining witnesses in our case? That they both, or both cases, both descriptions of the alleged misconduct suffered from significant credibility deficits. I believe that, if my memory serves me correctly, that Mia, the older child, made several different and significantly enhanced descriptions, or gave enhanced descriptions of the alleged misconduct at trial that she did not give in her statement to the police when she first disclosed, or at preliminary hearing when she admitted under cross-examination that she was not sure even if the things that she alleged her Uncle Tino had done had ever happened or if she had dreamed them. There was also testimony from other witnesses at the trial who gave their account of Mia's credibility as a person. That testimony was accepted by the court. It was heard by the jury. We know, at least from the evidence that was presented from the defense, that both her story and her credibility as a truthful young person suffered from terrible deficits that we do not believe the state overcame. In regard to the younger complainant, Emily, or E.V., we know that her story contained fantastical details that our expert witness testified marked or indicated probably a false memory or unfair bias or prejudice or influence in the forensic interview techniques that were displayed or shown by the detective who interviewed her at her disclosure. All of these things go to the main point of how this trial was so infected with unfairness by the joinder of the two stories, the stories of abuse, that it deprived Mr. Sanchez of his right to a fair trial and to due process because of the lack of cross-admissibility, because these did not represent a common scheme or plan, and because they clearly were not part of the same transaction. The trial court further erred by failing to proffer a limiting instruction guiding the jury's consideration of the evidence pertaining to the joint charges. Our case law here tells us under Rhimes v. State that a limiting instruction is required upon the admission of any bad act evidence and at the conclusion of the trial when the jury departs to deliberate. In our case, the trial court gave neither.
Mr. Speed, did the defense proffer a limiting instruction or ask for one?
He did not ask for a limiting instruction, Your Honor, but the case law says that because a defendant does not ask for a limiting instruction, it does not relieve the court of its duty sua sponte to offer one when this kind of bad act evidence is sought to be introduced by the state. There was a motion to sever at the beginning of our trial before our trial even proceeded, and there was also a renewal of our motion to sever once we began jury selection and trial in earnest. At neither point did the court live up to its obligation to give us an instruction limiting the use of the bad act evidence by the state. All of these things considered together, Mr. Justice's these failures by the court warrant reversal. We know that, considered individually, that they may be harmless, but because we have argued that this is harmless error of a constitutional dimension, these errors by the state warrant reversal here because the state cannot demonstrate to this court that those errors were harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. What does that mean? What standard would they have to meet? It is their burden to show that these errors contained or made a substantial or injurious effect, had a substantial or injurious effect or influence in determining the jury's verdict. We challenge the state to prove to the court that this misjoinder would not do that then. We renew that challenge this afternoon, Your Honors. We do not believe that the state can show that trying these cases together did not present the jury with a situation where one case buttressed the other, or the weaker case was made stronger because the jury heard testimony about another case. I believe that what occurred in Mr. Sanchez's trial was that the jury was so disturbed and so put out by these allegations of sexual abuse by someone who was portrayed by the state as a favorite uncle, that they convicted Mr. Sanchez because they thought that he was a bad person. And under Walker versus State, we know that that is impermissible as well. Moving on to the prosecutorial misconduct prong of our argument. There were several instances of prosecutorial misconduct that I believe warrant reversal in this case, and that the law demands warrant reversal in this case. Laying them out in a similar fashion to how Jefferson laid out his grievances against the king, we saw that the deputy made a comparison to a notorious criminal during her cross-examination of the defense's expert witness. We saw that she pressured the defendant's witnesses into accusing others of lying by asking questions that went along the lines of, if witness B were to say that witness A did something, would that person be a liar? And we've seen in Gaxiola versus State, this court has held in Gaxiola versus State, that the mere asking of that question is flagrant misconduct. We saw that she improperly disparaged the defendant and vouched for the complaining witnesses and used a clever and resourceful disavowal to avoid any outward appearance of misconduct, at least in front of the court at the time. The way that it played out was that the question was posed or the argument was made something along the lines of, I'm not saying that Mr. Sanchez's argument is not to be believed or is ridiculous, but if the court does, if the jury does believe those arguments, then this 8-year-old and 19-year-old girl have to be sophisticated masterminds who orchestrated, executed, and devised, who planted the seeds, who manipulated, who were diabolical, who were Oscar-worthy actresses to believe that the things that Mr. Sanchez is proffering had to be true. If you believe what Mr. Sanchez is saying, then you have to believe all of those things about the two complaining witnesses, people who were already given, we believe, enormous sympathy by the court based on simply the two charges being tried together. She argued facts that were not in evidence and sought to inflame the passions and prejudices and shifted the burden of proof. And all of those things combined, even if the court sees that some of them would have been harmless by themselves, when viewed as a whole, they constituted cumulative error. And we believe that because of these repeated instances of misconduct, Mr. Sanchez's conviction should be reversed. Finally, in my last few seconds, we argue in our brief that there were racial and gender discrimination or practices of racial and gender discrimination in the state selection of its jury, which was a violation under Batson versus Kentucky. Those violations constituted structural error, and we believe that they also should merit reversal of Mr. Sanchez's conviction.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Stone. Ms. Fleck?
Good afternoon, Justices.
Good afternoon, too.
I'd like to start by talking about the disclosure in this case, and I think that that's the most important thing to understand in order to understand why these two victims were so intertwined. The first complaining victim was 7 years old. She was at her house. Her parents told her that their favorite uncle, Uncle Tino Sanchez, was coming to visit, and all the kids got excited. Her mom went to the bathtub. She went into the bathroom with her mother, and she said, "Mommy, Uncle Tino can't come. He cannot come to visit." She put her hands to her face. She slid down the wall, started crying, and said, "He touches me." Her parents immediately called the police, and while the police were there, her 19-year-old sister came home, or 17 at the time, sister came home from college, happened to walk in on this disclosure, and at that time, she also found out about the disclosure from Emily, and that's when she disclosed. She had never told anyone before that day that Uncle Tino had molested her when she was little. She had, however, told her counselor and her mom some 6 months before that she was molested by an uncle who lived in California. So the disclosure of Mia comes because of the disclosure of Emily, and they are inextricably intertwined. You could not tell the story of Mia without telling the story of Emily and how that disclosure came out. Furthermore, I think that the defense, the appellant, misses the point of the case law in terms of joinder and what it takes in order for cases to be cross-admissible. The second part of the joinder statute, meaning or being that the evidence of each charge would be admissible in the separate charges trials of the other. Under Bronstein, the court has then rejected the idea that this propensity evidence will always be relevant, but that you would have to go through the three-part test in Tinch, meaning is it relevant, is it proven by clear and convincing evidence, and then the probative value being substantially outweighing the prejudicial effect. So under that analysis, clearly these two victims would be admissible against each other in any trial. Besides the res gestae of telling the complete story because of how the disclosures came out, under for any other purpose, under motive, we see in Richmond, then later, which is not cited, that Ledbetter, that the motive of why somebody would do this, why somebody would act, why a person would sexually touch or would have sexual feelings for a child. So I think that under the second part of the joinder statute, there's absolutely no way that it would that these two victims would not come into the same trial together under a bad act, that they are intertwined, that they are sufficiently connected, and therefore it clearly could not be abuse of discretion that the court found that they should be tried together.
Also, how do we deal with the prejudice prong, though, of this? We have two people who were allegedly victims as minors. They are both in, as often is the case, isolated situations. There's no other witnesses except for the victim. I understand if the victim is credible, that's sufficient by itself. But why is this not prejudicial because of the, in essence, vouching that you kind of get into with the dual testimony?
Well, I think that the standard isn't whether or not it's prejudicial. Of course it is prejudicial, but it's that the prejudice would have to substantially outweigh the probative value. You know, the fact that the defendant engaged in...
Well, I'm asking the question not because from the standpoint of, say, the prosecution's mind, but how do you convince the court that it is a proper function of applying a fair trial, allowing for due process in this situation? We have incidents that are 10 years apart. The first one, the second victim, is not even born. And you've not truly established how this comes together. But I come to you because what we have in actuality and actual fact is this overlapping. If we come to the court, come to the jury with two individuals, and they're both of the same family and so on, maybe it's more believable. Why is this not so prejudicial? Why is it not patently unfair?
Well, I mean, like I was going to say, the defendant perpetrated on two separate victims. So the question would be, would we have separate trials where that evidence would still come in, and it would still come in a as a bad act evidence? I mean, all of the case law would say, under Braunstein, under Ledbetter, under Richmond, that these facts and circumstances would allow for the second victim to come in this case as another bad act.
Counsel, that's possibly a real stretch because you're talking about clear and convincing. You're talking about trial within a trial.
Well, I would just ask them to look at the specific cases that are on point with this that have allowed that kind of evidence in for motive or for intent or for opportunity, absence of mistake. Under Richmond.
I'm looking at severance, I'm looking at how it's defined, common scheme, plan, that type of thing. And so I'm trying to fit it in there.
Are you really viewing those cases more broadly than what they really stand for? Isn't the focus on what specific exception to the general prohibition to other act evidence, the admissibility of other act evidence, applies? In Richmond, it was a preconceived plan, so it was common scheme or plan. Which of the exceptions apply here?
Well, I think that motive would apply here, which we get from Richmond, which is that the mental operation that leads a person to commit a sexual assault upon a minor child, while not providing a legal excuse to criminal liability, does explain why the event was perpetrated, and that the mental aberration that leads a person to commit the sexual assault for intent, the touching of Mia years earlier that went to his lascivious intent in touching Emily, absence of mistake, certainly when the defense presents two different theories with two different victims, one being one child is prone to these fantastical details and she's just confused and, this must be a mistake. But then you have a second child that comes in, and then what is it with her? Then it's, oh no, she's got problems, she's a problem child, she's prone to lying and to cheating and to deceiving. It would be offered and I believe rightfully brought into that trial under that specific ground.
Under that analysis, it would seem possibly that there's cross-admissibility of Rita's testimony under a Tinch analysis in a trial in which the complaining witness is E.V., but I'm not sure the same can be said about the testimony or the events involving E.V. in a trial in which the complaining witness is Mia.
Well, and I understand what you're saying, and I guess it would be similar to...
I think we can just assume that it's cross-admissible in both cases.
Well...
And doesn't that impact the separability analysis?
Well, I think in this particular case where the evidence for each specific victim is the same. You know, I believe that in cases where other bad act evidence that was much stronger was being allowed into a case that had much weaker evidence, then that would be much more prejudicial. But in this particular case
that a defendant commits the acts 10 years later in their life, and that evidence then becomes a basis for admissibility in a criminal charge that occurred 10 years before.
Well, I mean, in this particular case, you know, once Mia kind of grew out, Emily grew in. You know, I mean, this was an age that the defendant, he perpetrated these sexual acts, you know, taking his hand and inserting it into small children's vaginas, the same age. So, you know, I understand that there's that time, the 10 years, but given the nature of these crimes, given the nature of the disclosures, given the fact that she disclosed 10 years later and why, and how inextricably intertwined that disclosure is, given how, you know, the events come about of what Mia says. I think that the evidence, if it was the other way around, the evidence with both victims is similar in that it is more or less their testimony, their particular personal experiences as the most of the evidence. So I don't think that there is a danger that one is much more outweighed by the other.
What about propensity in this of this joinder here? How do you get around propensity? I mean, isn't that what the district court was trying to prove at trial, that this person did this propensity-type defense?
Absolutely not. And that's from Richmond, that it's, you know, it isn't propensity, but that this is a motive, that the mental aberration that leads a person to do this kind of an act is relevant. These victims would have stood on their own. The defense argument, or the appellant argument, if you actually compare it to the record, you know, that this child, Emily, was prone to fantastical details, that she's not credible. There's one inconsistency that the appellant was able to draw out in her testimony, and that was that at trial she testified that the defendant used his fingers to put them inside of her vagina, and Mr. Speed was able to cross-examine her and say, you didn't always say fingers. Isn't it true that you told your counselor he used his hands? And as a 10-year-old child, she looked at him like, I know I'm only 10, but isn't that the same thing? That is the sole inconsistency in her fantastical story after 5 hours of testimony. With this other, the other girl, Mia, there's no credibility issues with her either. The one issue that the defense relied upon is that at her school, when she was a teenager, she lied about having a hall pass, or getting a hall pass in order to go and play tennis. That is the sole issue with that particular child. So, where, you know, they presented, as they did at trial, that she is not to be trusted, that she has all of these problems, that she was an attention seeker, but that is void in every single, in all of the records, which is what the jury found.
So what I worry about is that if we follow your line of thinking, in every molestation case, if there's a subsequent or a previous molestation, it's going to be joined. And I can't understand why, you know, the district attorney can't try these cases on the facts of a particular case rather than trying to join every type of molestation. I mean, we have the word propensity, and I think what you did is you defined propensity in this particular situation by calling it motive. And I just don't understand where your office comes from on this particular thing. I mean, is it just a taboo situation where it's a completely different case that there won't be joinder, and every other type of sexual assault, molestation, lewdness will be joined without any problem?
I don't think that the Tavish case, respectfully, is on point at all. In this, I mean, the reasoning in that case is that was the motive. The only motive is or connection was money or greed.
Motive. It's motive.
But that was not enough to link those.
Why wasn't it enough in Tavish, but it's enough in this one?
Well, first of all, the suggestion that, you know, why doesn't the district attorney's office try them separately? Well, because the law says that we can join them and that we can try them together. And that...
But you have to worry about the probative value is outweighed by prejudicial effect. It can't be for propensity. So, I mean, it's not cut and dry as far as I'm concerned.
Well, in the other cases, specifically in Richmond, that's how that lays motive out. It's the specific verbiage from the case talks about motive and talks about the mental aberration that leads a person to a sexual assault, and that why a person acts is relevant, and why a person acts is relevant in order to bring in another bad act, and that it's much more probative than prejudicial in this kind of a case. So to suggest that the district attorney's office is trying to do something that's sort of underhanded,
I don't suggest that at all. I just think that we have case law that talks about the probative value being outweighed by prejudicial effect, and certainly this is prejudicial. My God, this is where there's smoke, there's fire. I mean, look what this guy did. He did it twice. He did it a number of times to two different victims in the same family. It's the uncle thing. And I just think that sometimes we've got to set forth exactly about the probative value being outweighed by prejudicial effect, and that you're really putting it in for propensity to say he did it, he's doing it again, and not motive.
And in cases where, this is in the same family. These are not separated by state, by victims, by people that don't know each other, just some other random person. It's the same family, it's the same, the disclosure comes out at the same time. One disclosure causes the next disclosure. So I think that, the cases that say that it was much more prejudicial than probative, the evidence and the facts and the circumstances are much, much different than this case. Would you like me to address any of the prosecutorial misconduct claims?
I did want you to address the one regarding the reference to Penn State and Sandusky, please.
Okay. The expert in the state, Dr. O'Donohue, went through the entire direct examination and talked a lot about the McMartin trial. The McMartin trial being a very highly publicized trial from the 80s that hundreds upon hundreds of children are interviewed in California, and they are saying all kinds of incredible things, seeing witches. He then went on to use that trial as the basis to say that there are fantastical details in disclosures and in interviews. In our case, the victim, Emily, says that at one point her brother was in the group. Now, the defense also continued to say that she saw it, but she was very, very particular. Very particular, where she said to Mr. Speed, "I never said he saw it. I said he was there." At 10 years old, she was very specific to point that out. But the expert's opinion was that this was a fantastical detail, that it could absolutely never happen, that it would never happen that somebody would perpetrate crimes in front of another person, and that it would never happen that somebody would see something and not report it. And he used what I would deem one of the most sensational cases. I think at the time that case ended, it was the most expensive case in history. Hundreds of kids had been interviewed and no resulting prosecution. Although the prosecution never went anywhere, but they were found not guilty. So he used an extremely sensational case. I think it's absolutely proper to be able to comment then on this fantastical detail that's found in another case. It was never commenting on Mr. Sandusky. Well, first of all, what's actually in the record is basically the word Penn State. So you've heard of Penn State. And that was it. Objection was sustained. We moved on. It was never argued. So to suggest that there was any error to the defendant in that phrase, Penn State. But, so really what my intention was after the fact is not really relevant to what was before the jury. But clearly from the questions that were being asked before that comment, it was about the fantastical detail about a witness and somebody who observed this this interaction as opposed to ever the defendant. So that's kind of a big leap to suggest that comparison was ever made. Some of the other portions of prosecutorial misconduct, meaning the idea about the conspiracy and commenting or denigrating the defense. Again, never denigrating the defense attorney or the defendant, but certainly that was a proper argument and inference after the defense, which was you have two victims, one is prone to fantastical detail and the other is lying. And is basically a bad girl. There was a comment about characterizing the charges as horrific crimes, and the defense attorney basically has her theory as horrific. That, again, was in response to Mr. Speed characterizing the girls as horrific, and Mia specifically as making horrific statements, and specifically that she's a horrific girl because she was put in, or horrible, I think it was, girl, because she was put in a position of trust by a school. And how horrible is it that put in this position of trust that she would violate it by stealing this hall pass? And that was a comment then of, you know, what's horrific is to be put in a position of trust as somebody in the family. So I think actually as you go through each of the instances of prosecutorial misconduct in context, they don't amount to misconduct at all. I know that we're I'm well over my time.
Yeah. Thank you. I wondered if the panel had any other questions. I have just one remaining question. Was the testimony by Mia, if I pronounced her name right, in the preliminary hearing as Mr. Speed characterized it, introduced into the trial?
In terms of?
Her concern that she may have actually dreamed these charges.
Yes, it was absolutely brought out on cross-examination, and I think that it was the way that she explained it was more that she had repressed it, that she didn't want to believe it happened, that she didn't want to think about it, but it was absolutely also brought out that it was something that she had talked about, that she was then seeking counseling for, that she was starting to address by well before the disclosure came out.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate your arguments and briefs in this case. You've done an outstanding job here this afternoon, and we thank you both. The matter will stand submitted.